The following teaching is brought to you by Crosspoint Church. For sermon notes and other resources, visit gotocrosspoint.com.
I'm going to pray for us real quick over our time, and then we're going to jump in. Jesus, thank you so much for who you are, for what you've done. Lord, I'm asking right now for all of these folks in here, myself included, any distractions that we've carried in this morning, man, heartaches, heavy stuff, struggles, whatever it is, would you just help us to set it down for a little bit here? Lord, change us, teach us, remind us, whatever it is that we need this morning, would you do that? Lord, we give this time to you. It's in your wonderful name, amen. So if you guys haven't been with us throughout the last five chapters in the book of Romans, what's been kind of cool as you kind of look at the big themes that Paul is writing about, we've said it before that this is kind of like a courtroom drama that's playing out, right? Paul is the prosecuting attorney, and he's making a lot of big arguments throughout these last five chapters. And what's cool is as you step back and take a look at that, you see that there's this big overshadowing idea above all of those arguments, and it's the idea of God's grace. God's grace is greater than God's grace. Over and over and over again, Paul is talking about, hey, your sin is more serious than you realize. This is what your sin does. It's eternally separating us from God. But how much greater is this wonderful gift that God has given? Jews, Gentiles, you, me, us, them, it doesn't matter who you are. You're not born into this thing. God's grace is made available for everybody. And then last weekend, Steve was talking to us about Adam and Eve and kind of how sin was introduced into the world. By this one man, Adam, sin came into the world, but how much greater is this wonderful gift of grace introduced by one man, Jesus, into the world? And so Paul is going to continue to drive the nail home on this idea of God's grace over and over and over again. And he's done that so much, and he's ran into a little bit of criticism. It's actually relayed to us in chapter 3. If you go back there, chapter 3, verse 8, he says, "And some people even slander us by claiming that we say, the more we sin, the better it is." And it's as he describes here in verse 1 of chapter 6. Well then, should we keep on sinning so that God can show more and more of his wonderful grace? See, this was kind of a weird excuse and justification that his audience was starting to make. What? Like, if God's grace is so awesome, man, then we can just do whatever we want. We can just keep on sinning because God is gracious. He's going to forgive us. And I think what Paul's doing here, he's taking the time here in chapter 6 to let them know, to let us know, don't miss the point. We've talked a lot about God's grace, but don't miss it. And here's the idea that we need to understand first and foremost about God's grace. God's grace is not an excuse or license to just do whatever you want to keep on doing. Also, God's grace is not just the thing that saves you from sin. What we need to recognize about grace is it's the very thing that allows us to have power over sin. God's grace is the thing that's going to deliver us from sin. And so what Paul is saying, I'm saying this over and over again, because without God's grace, you're not going to be able to fight back against sin. So no, it's not an excuse to keep on doing what you want. He's saying you need this. You're going to need this to fight back. God's grace is the thing that enables us to do that. Your Bibles may have this header and above chapter 6. Mine says, sin's power is broken. Can you guys say that with me? Sin's power is broken. That is something that we need to recognize that grace does. Grace is the thing that broke the power of sin because of what Jesus did. And so Paul is going to overemphasize it, and we're going to talk about it over and over and over again here at Crosspoint. You will hear us talk about grace so much. And the reason being is because a lot of churches get into trouble when they don't talk enough about God's grace. Because when you start to do that, if you're not careful, you start to think it's up to me to just do better and be a better person. No, we start with God's grace, recognizing that without that, we are powerless to fight back against sin. And because of this wonderful grace that God has given us now, the last five chapters, again, he's been hounding this thing over and over. God's grace, God's grace, God's grace. Now here in chapter 6, we're going to see kind of a shift in what Paul starts to do. Now we're going to see what it means to live this new life that Jesus has given us. What is this Christian life supposed to look like? So I am really excited to dive into that with you guys this morning. God's grace is so important, but don't miss it also. it's not just God's grace that you need. Again, God's grace is where we start. That's the thing that you need first. But you and I also have to make the choice whether or not we want to follow God's ways, which we will talk more about here soon. But Paul writes this in Philippians chapter 2, verse 12. He says, work hard to show the results of your salvation. Work hard. You have to put work into it. Obeying God with deep reverence and fear. He says, for God is working in you. That's grace. Giving you the desire and the power to do what pleases him. So the question comes up sometimes. So what is it? Is it grace or is it me? Is it me doing it or is it God doing it? And the answer is yes. It's both. It's God's grace enabling you and giving you the power to do what pleases him, but us working hard to show the results of our salvation. It's a twofold thing going on there. But to avoid this criticism that Paul has kind of had placed on him, we need to see he is not being flippant about sin by talking about God's grace. If anything, he's trying to help his readers, he's trying to help us understand that grace is the solution to the problem we found ourselves in. He's not flippant about sin, he's saying grace is the solution to it. And so he continues here. Well, verse 1, so should we keep on sinning so that God can show us more and more of his wonderful grace? Of course not! Since we have died to sin, how can we continue to live in it? Since we have died to sin, how can we continue to live in it? It sounds like a really good phrase. We've died to sin. That sounds really powerful, right? Many of us have probably heard that phrase. But as I read this, I go, what does that mean? What does that actually mean, dead to sin? There's this really great sounding analogy that folks have used in the past to describe what this means, this idea that Paul's talking about, dead to sin. What does that mean? The way that's described is if you imagine a corpse that's unresponsive, unmoved. Being dead to sin means that you're being unmoved, just undeterred by sin and temptation. And that sounds great. Like, yeah, man, I want to get to a place in my life like that, where I just, temptation has no hold over me, that when that just comes my way, I'm just unmoved by it. That sounds cool, but the problem with it is that it's biblically inaccurate. That analogy just doesn't work because it goes against everything Paul is going to continue to write about. And if that's actually the case, if that's how we're supposed to be towards sin, then I guess I'm not a Christian. I guess you're not a Christian. I guess Paul's not a Christian. Nobody I know then is a Christian because I have not met one person that has been unmoved by sin, unmoved and undeterred by temptation. It's just not the case. And I feel that this is important that we recognize this morning, church, because a lot of us, maybe we carry this doubt sometimes of like, man, is something wrong with me? If this is what the Bible's saying, if I'm supposed to be dead to sin, I don't feel dead to sin. I'm still tempted all the time. I'm still slipping up here. I'm still making mistakes here. Am I really a Christian? Has God really saved me? When is that going to happen in my life? And I'm going to tell you right now, it's not going to happen till the day that you leave this earth. It's the process of sanctification. It's continuously becoming to look more and more like Jesus. That is not going to stop until the day that you and I die. You will not get to a place in this life where you will have made it as a Christian. Be like, I'm good. No, it's just not the case. And Paul will continue to talk about this as we continue. Stay tuned for the next few weeks as Paul talks about his own struggles in that as well. And so I love that Steve talked about this last week, Adam and Eve, how sin was introduced in the world. Be mindful of this. Adam and Eve lived in paradise. They had everything that God gave them. They actually were the only people that for a little bit got to live within God's design for life. And even they were tempted and chose to go an opposite way. So my thing is with that, don't beat yourself up too much. You're not going to be perfect. You're going to struggle with sin. Being dead to sin does not mean that you're not going to want to sin. It doesn't mean that you're not ever going to sin again. This is not what Paul is trying to tell us. So then what is he trying to tell us? Well, let's continue reading here in verse 5. He says, since we've been united with Jesus in his death, we will also be raised to life as he was. We know that our old sinful selves were crucified with Christ so that sin might lose its power in our lives. We are no longer slaves to sin. For when we died with Christ, we were set free from the power of sin. And since we died with Christ, we know that we will also live with him. We are sure of this because Christ was raised from the dead, and he will never die again. Death no longer has any power over him. When he died once to break the power of sin, but now that he lives for the glory of God. So you guys need to highlight, circle, underline, whatever you want to do with these next two words. Consider yourselves. Let that be a reminder for you today. If you don't remember anything from today, just remember those two words. Consider yourselves to be dead to the power of sin and alive to God through Christ Jesus. So, what Paul is trying to get at here, he says, look, since we've been united with Christ, and if you go back a few verses before, he talks about baptism, that this symbol that we do where we dip people into the water that represents dying to the old self. I'm done with that way of life and coming back up into new life because of what Jesus has done. That's the symbol of baptism. He's saying, look, because that's happened, you've been united with Christ in what he did. He died to break the power of sin. You and I didn't die to break the power of sin. We didn't die when we got dipped down in the water, but because Jesus did, Paul is saying, you've been united with him now in that same death. You know what's so cool about that? It means that what it meant for Jesus, the dead to the power of sin, what it meant for him means it means the same for you and I if you've placed your faith in him. You didn't die to break the power of sin, but because Jesus did, it counts for you. How wonderful is that? That's so cool. But he says, look, since that's the case, we can be so sure of this because of what Jesus did, that now you should also consider yourselves dead to sin. Because of Jesus, you should now consider yourselves dead to sin. I love those two words. In Romans 12:2, Paul says something really, really cool that we're going to capitalize and talk about a lot today. He says, let your lives be transformed by changing the way you think. Or some other translations say, by the renewing of your mind. Let your lives be transformed, not by changing the way that you behave, not by changing the way that you talk, not by changing your routines and your habits. No, he says, let your lives be transformed by changing the way you think. This is where everything starts. This is where every choice that we make begins. This is where the thought of every word that comes out of our mouths comes from. And so Paul is trying to say, look, you need to pay attention to what you're thinking about. And I think these two terms coincide together. So you should consider yourselves, or a better way to say that is you should think of yourselves the same, dead to sin. How do you think about yourself, church? If you've placed your faith in Jesus, how do you consider yourself? Because a lot of us, maybe if we're honest, man, I don't consider myself dead to sin for a variety of reasons. I'm going to tell you guys that the majority of the battle that you're going to have in this life as you follow Christ and as you fight with sin is going to be how you think about it. It's going to be how you think about sin. It's going to be how you think about God. It's going to be how you think about yourself. That's where a lot of your fight is going to lie. And so how then should we consider ourselves? Dead to the power, dead to sin, what does that mean? There's going to be two fill in the blanks there on your note sheet of how we should be considering ourselves. The first one is this, free from the penalty of sin. What it means to be dead to sin means that you are free from the penalty of sin. What's the penalty of sin? Well, he says it here in verse 23. He says, the wages of sin is death. Or the payment for sin is death. And now certainly you and I are all going to pass away at some point in our lives. That's not what Paul is saying, that you're never going to die. You will leave this earth. But remember what sin does? It eternally separated us from God. And so what Paul is saying is, guess what? Now that you've placed your faith in Jesus, you're free from that penalty. You are free from that eternal separation from God. That means that you will be with him forever. He said that here in whatever it was. He said, we can be sure that we will live with him. You are no longer eternally separated from him. You are free from the penalty. We're not going to keep going on this because the last five chapters of Romans have really talked a lot about this, what sin does. So I'd encourage you to go back and listen to some of that if you've missed it. But moving on, the next point there, dead to sin also means that we're free from the power of sin. We are free from the power of sin. Before Christ, we were powerless to fight back. We were powerless to find an escape route. We were powerless to rescue and save ourselves, but because of what Jesus did, he's now given us a way out. This is what Paul writes in 1 Corinthians 10:13. He says, God is faithful. He will not allow temptation to be more than you can stand. When you are tempted, he will show you a way out so that you can endure. That's not him saying, hey, look, God's not going to give you anything more than you can handle. He absolutely will, man. You will absolutely have more than you can handle. But he's saying, look, he will always give you a way out. Every single time there will be a way out. A great way that folks have put this in the past, a good analogy, is look, before Jesus, you and I were kind of like trapped in a jail cell, if that makes sense. There was no way out. We couldn't get out of there ourselves. But because of what Jesus has done now, he's opened up that jail door and said, you're free. But you and I still have to make the choice to step out of that jail cell. And that's where a lot of the difficulty, I feel, lies for us. Maybe we know that the cell door is open, but it's really hard to step out of that sometimes. I think this is an important thought for some of you today that might have wrestled with this for a long time of, man, my sin, you just don't understand, Justin. It's so much. It's so hard. There's no way out. Or I hear a lot of guys say stuff like this. I've said it before too, so I'm guilty as well. I'm just going to be dealing with this for the rest of my life. You heard people say that? I don't know if that's necessarily true. I feel like we convince ourselves of that, and we go, nah, this will just be something I deal with forever. Maybe not. Maybe God's given you that power to escape that, and you just don't recognize that he's given you his spirit and the power to do so. Loved getting to talk with some folks about this as we prepared. Our friend Ryan that you heard from, he reminded me of something really cool, that even the Israelites that were rescued from slavery in Egypt, God parted the Red Sea for them, saved his people. They're wandering through the wilderness, and they have a lot of challenges ahead of them still. And at some point in Numbers 14, the challenges become too much, so they're like, let's just go back. Let's appoint a new leader, and let's just go back to Egypt. That was better than trying to fight. That was easier than trying to get through this. And I feel like sometimes you're in my response to sin is the same. Man, it's just easier to deal with this. Some of you know who've been broken or addicted for a long time just know that that's so much easier. Man, I'm just used to the addiction. I'm used to dealing with the repercussions that the addiction brings. I don't want to fight back. It's just too hard sometimes. How do you consider yourselves? Dead to sin, free from the power of it? And so the question I'd like you guys to wrestle with today, maybe as you leave and you go about your week, as you think about what it means to be dead to sin, free from the penalty of sin and free from the power of sin, do you really believe that those things are true about you? Think about that. Do you really believe that? That if you've placed your faith in Jesus, do you believe that those things are true about you? Again, so much of that fight will have to do with how you consider yourself and what you think. And then lastly, with this idea of being dead to sin, when we recognize sin for what it really is, the destruction and the chaos that it brings, I feel like it doesn't take a really smart person to recognize that sin has done some pretty awful things to the world, right? It destroys relationships. It breaks people apart. I feel like you don't even need to really be a follower of Jesus to recognize that sin has just done a number on this world. So when we recognize it for what it is, you know when something is really bad, or if you've ever heard a little kid, for you parents, maybe you've heard them use this phrase before when they don't want to do something that sounds really hard or really challenging for them, and they go, oh, I'd rather die. Have you heard them say that phrase before? I'd rather die than do that. It's just like so dramatic. This phrase, I'd rather die, I was thinking about that a lot with my response to sin, and at least for me personally and folks that I know that have really strayed far down that path and that road of sin that brought brokenness and pain and addiction and loneliness. I mean, if you've experienced that kind of life, I feel like my response to sin sometimes is, when I recognize sin for what it is, I'd rather die than go back to that, man. I'd rather die than go back to the way life was. Some of you know that all too well, and I feel like it might be easier for some of us that have dealt with that. Man, there's no way I'm going back. But Steve reminded me this week, he goes, yeah, but for someone like me, Steve saying, he goes, I never really got a taste of what that life looked like. He goes, I've always been curious what it would be like to go down that road of sin. Man, it certainly looks great from the outside. It can't be that bad, can it? And so if that's you today, If you've never really gotten a taste of what sin does and what it brings in your life, my hope is that this next portion that we're going to talk through would be especially helpful for you and encouraging for you to recognize that God is looking out for you far more than you realize. So let's continue reading here in verse 15. Well then, he says it again, since God's grace has set us free from the law, does that mean we can go on sinning? Of course not. Don't you realize that you become the slave of whatever you choose to obey? You should highlight that verse. Don't you realize that you become the slave of whatever you choose to obey? You can be a slave to sin, which leads to death, or you can choose to obey God, which leads to righteous living. Thank God, once you were slaves to sin, but now you wholeheartedly obey this teaching that we've given you. Now you are free from your slavery to sin, and you have become slaves to righteous living. I heard a great motivational line somewhere a long time ago. It said, don't be a slave to anything. And I was like, that sounds cool, man. Don't let anything control you. Don't be a slave to anything. And that sounds cool and all. It's a great tagline for a motivational speech, but it's just not true. I don't know if you realize it or not, you and I were made to worship something. All of us were made to worship something. And I think that Paul nails that there in verse 16. He says, don't you realize that you become the slave to whatever you choose to obey, whatever you choose to spend time doing, whatever lifestyle you commit to? Don't you realize that you become a slave to those things? It's important that we understand what Paul meant when he's talking about slavery here. It's probably not the thought that comes to you in my mind when we think of slavery, race-based slavery or anything like that. What Paul's really talking about here is this idea of bond servitude. If you've heard of that, this was very commonplace when Paul was writing this letter. I read something that said around the time of Jesus, there was probably approximately 1/3 of the Roman population that were bond servants. It's this idea of working for somebody to pay off a debt. Sometimes it was even voluntary. Sometimes it was, hey, working for that person, giving away my rights to go work for that person is going to be better than my life right now. So I'm just going to go do that. Right? People would give themselves over to masters. And the interesting thing that we need to be mindful of, too, is that there was a big difference between a good master and a bad master. There was a big difference between a good master and a bad master, okay? So, I'm a youth pastor, so we like to talk with students and try and get them to talk with us as well. So, help me out here. I got a question for you guys. Just shout it out. When you guys hear the word freedom, what comes to mind? Freedom. Don't say America. Someone said America last night. Don't say that. When you think of the word freedom, what comes to mind?
Debt.
What?
Debt.
Debt? What else?
Consequences.
What else? Freedom. What does freedom mean? One more. Someone's got it. What is it?
Broken chains.
Okay, so like freedom from something, chains, right? Last night some folks said no rules. No rule. Freedom means no rules. Do whatever you want to do. I feel like for some of us, our idea of freedom is that. Man, it's the freedom and choice to do whatever I want to do. Man, no rules, no boundaries, no limitations, no restrictions on my life. Does that sound great? Okay, it might sound great. Now, for those of you that have lived that kind of lifestyle of freedom, does it ever end well? Does it ever end well? No. No limitations, no boundaries, no rules, the freedom to do whatever you want. It certainly never ends well. Too much water can kill you. Water intoxication, water poisoning. I'm sure you guys have heard of that. A woman back in 2007 passed away on a radio game show because she drank too much water in a few hours and she didn't use the restroom. The doctor said she might as well have been drunk because she drank too much water. No limitations, no boundaries. I guess if we're considering it in this context, might possibly even kill you. This was what the prodigal son realized in that parable that Jesus shared in Luke. After he had squandered his father's money on women, wild living, whatever else that we didn't see, the verses that we didn't get in that chapter. And he's sitting in a pig pen, starving. And he goes, man, even my father's servants have food to spare. And here I am. No limitations, doing whatever I want. It didn't end well for him, and it certainly doesn't end well for us. stumbled across a verse recently that I loved and took some time to really think about. It was so beneficial and helpful for me, church, and I hope that it will be for you today as well. John chapter 15, verse 10. Jesus is talking to his disciples, 11 of them now, because Judas had already dipped out. His 11 disciples, right before Jesus is about to be arrested and betrayed, and so he's dropping some gems to his disciples before he goes. Like, things are about to get real, and so Jesus has got some really crucial stuff to say. And in John 15, 10, he says, "When you obey my commandments, you remain in my love. When you obey my commandments, you remain in my love." Now, it's important to know what Jesus is not saying there. He's not saying, if you obey me, I'll love you. That's not what he's saying. His love for you is boundless regardless of what you do. What he's actually trying to tell his disciples and us, I believe, in that verse, he's saying, when you remain in my commandments, or sorry, when you obey my commands, when you trust the boundaries and restrictions that I've placed on you, when you hear thou shalt and thou shalt not, when you trust me and you do those things, he says, you get to experience all the benefits of love and life that I have for you. When you obey my commands, you remain in my love. You get to experience the best life that God has designed for you when you trust that he has your best interests in mind. I think there's so many practical ways that we could talk about this. One of the examples that I have is like an argument, for example. I was thinking about arguments with friends, or even better, like an argument with your spouse, right? They can get tense if we're not careful, right? And so for me, when I consider an argument, I have two choices, right? I can do it my way, which is I'm going to get easily frustrated. I'm going to get defensive. I'm going to do everything I can to prove my point and that I'm right, right? That never ends well in an argument when I choose to do it my way, ever. It's never ended well. And if anything, it actually makes the problem worse. The argument goes on for hours at a time, and I'm like, gosh, why did I do that? But see, when I choose God's way instead, when I say, man, he's told me to be patient and kind and gentle, when I actually do things his way in an argument, when I lay down my right to be right for a minute, man, it just makes everything better every single time. Every single time. And if I'm lucky, like 5 minutes later, my wife will be like, yeah, I'm sorry, right? And I'm like, yes, it works. But that's the thing, it actually works. God's way just works so much better. God's way is so much better. When you obey my commandments, you remain in my love. John 10:10, Jesus says, the enemy comes to steal, kill, and destroy. The enemy being Satan, I think we could just say sin there as well. So what he's saying is sin comes to steal, kill, and destroy. Steal your joy, sap your peace, all of it. Steal, kill, and destroy. And then Jesus responds and he says, but I've come to give them life and life abundant. And that doesn't mean prosperity. What it means is the life that God had designed for you, you get to experience all of that. I love this quote C.S. Lewis has. He says, the Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. So when he looks at some of the choices that you and I make, he goes, really? That's pathetic. You want that? You want the pig pen like the prodigal son when I have life for you? The Lord finds our desires not too strong, but too weak. What you need to know about God's commands, it'll be the next fill in the blank if it hasn't already popped up for you there, is that God's commands are an invitation to life. That's what you need to know about God's commands. They are an invitation to life. I think the big idea that Paul is trying to put in front of us here, church, he's saying, when you consider sin for what it is and God's commands for what they are, he goes, why would you want to keep on sinning when you know that God has something so much better? Why would you want to keep sinning when you know that this way of life, being a slave to righteousness, leads to holiness and right living and something that's so much better? Why would you want to be a slave to sin? Why would you want to choose a bad master over God, who's a good master? Why would you want those things? Church, I'm curious what you think about God's commands. When you hear God say, thou shalt not, do you feel limited or do you feel loved and protected? Do you feel like God's keeping you on a leash like a dog sometimes, just away from everything that's fun and enjoyable, pleasurable life? No, oh, no, stay away from there. No, don't do that. Or do you recognize that he's trying to protect you from something that you can't see? The destruction and chaos that sin brings in life. He goes, I don't want that for you. Can you just go this way instead? This is so much better for you. Things are just going to end so much better if you trust me. Your life's going to be so much better if you just trust me. And not easier. It's not easy to do this. Don't miss that. It's not, hey, all your problems are going to go away when you choose to follow God. But he's saying, would you just trust that it's going to end so much better for you? God's commands are an invitation to life. Church, do you really believe that God's way is better for you? If you've come in here today and you found yourself in a state of mind, maybe recently, maybe for a while, where, especially for you Christians, right, where you've been following God for a long time and it's felt more like a drag for you than anything, where it's like, oh, I guess I'll do that because I know God said to. And look, I'm not saying that you need to be excited about following God's commands all the time. It's hard. But is obedience more of a drag to you than it is recognizing that it's what's best for you? If that's what you've been thinking about lately, I want to encourage you to do what Paul said there in Romans 12:2. Let your life be transformed by changing the way you think. How do you think about sin? How do you think about God's commands? I'd encourage you to check out Psalm 119. It's one of my favorite chapters in the Bible, and it talks so much about obedience, about trusting God's commands, about the joy that it brings, about the life that it brings when we trust him. Help me gain understanding that joyful are people of integrity that follow God's commands. So much of that is in there. I was talking to a woman last night who said, man, when I finally realized that in my faith, that God was not restricting me from the best life, but he was actually inviting me into a better life, she said, that was a game changer for me. Man, when you can follow God knowing that he has what's best, rather than like, oh, man, it just gets so much easier to say no to sin and yes to him. You're gonna be like, why would I want that when God's way is so much better? So I encourage you, church, to think about that as you guys go this week. And so now, as we've gone through this, we know two things. One, that we are surely dead to sin, meaning we're free from the penalty of sin, we're free from the power of sin. And then in that, knowing that we've been freed from that, we now have a choice. Every single day, I'd say, between being slaves to sin and slaves to righteousness, choosing a good master over a bad master. And I feel like sometimes we might teeter back and forth between the two. Some days I do allow myself to be a slave to sin, and I recognize the repercussions that come from it. Other days I, God, help me to see that your way is better today. And so we have this choice to make between the two. And what we saw is that being dead to sin does not mean you're not going to sin anymore. It doesn't mean you're not going to want to sin anymore. You're certainly going to want to go your own way at times, and so in this battle, this daily battle, I'd say we have, between choosing God's way over our own, between choosing sin and choosing righteousness, how can we start to change the way that we think about it? That's what I'd like to do. The last bit of our time here is I want to challenge you. How can we start to change the way that we think about choosing obedience over sin? There's three key things that I want to put before you today. I'm sure that there's so much more, but these are the three that I choose. So here we go. The first one is this. They're on your note sheet. How we change the way that we think about sin. What do you think? The first one is that we don't make excuses. Don't make excuses. When it comes to your sin, when it comes to your mistakes, your slip-ups, whatever, don't make excuses, okay? 1 Samuel and 2 Samuel. 1 Samuel, we get a picture. We're not going to read it. It's way too long, but I encourage you to read both of these stories. King Saul was the first king appointed over Israel. God gave Saul a very specific command to do something very specifically. Saul didn't do it. He did some of it, but he didn't do all of it. And so when Saul is confronted by a prophet, Saul goes, well, we did. We kind of did. We did. But I know that we didn't do that thing. I know that we kept this. I know. And he starts making excuse after excuse after excuse, trying to justify his behavior. And the prophet's like, what are you doing, dude? Well, I was afraid that the people... And you know what happens to Saul? as he makes excuses for his disobedience, he has his kingdom stripped away from him by God. God's not putting up with that. And then the next king, King David, right, is appointed over Israel. And eventually, at some point, David, you probably know that thing that David did. He took one of his best buddy's wives for himself. He sent him out to the battlefield and got him killed. He pulled the rest of the army back so that he would be struck down by arrows. Took his wife as his own. Got her pregnant. And as David is confronted for his sin, you know what his response is? In 2 Samuel, he says, "I've sinned before the Lord." That's what he says. When he's confronted, he says, "I have sinned before the Lord." You know what he does there? He owns it. He doesn't make excuses for it. And there's a big difference there between Saul and David and their response. And you know what's wild about those two stories? When I think about it, when we were brainstorming this, we go, man, David's disobedience seemed like a heck of a lot worse than Saul's, man. Like a lot worse. But it's our response to the sin that matters so much more than we realize. Are you making excuses trying to justify it, or do you own it? You know the beautiful thing about when we own our sin as church? We talked about this on Good Friday. When you own your sin and you give it to Jesus, say, yep, that's mine, and I know that Jesus took it. You know what's so cool about that? When your sin's on the cross, it's not yours anymore. Jesus paid the price for it. But in order to get to that point, you have to own it yourself. Because when you blame and justify and make excuses, you don't get to experience that. Can we just learn lessons from these folks in the Bible? Gosh, last week it was Adam, right? Adam's when they got confronted by God, God's like, it's the woman that you gave me. It's her fault. She did it, right? Just blaming and excuses. Don't make excuses. Own your sin. I believe that God honors our honesty, especially when it involves our own mistakes. He honors our honesty when it involves our mistakes. And then the second thing here is this. The way that we can start to change the way that we think about sin is that we turn from the sin and shame. Turn from sin and shame. My youth pastor told me years and years ago, we were talking about this, struggling with sin, our response to sin, and he said, you need to learn to be obedient in your disobedience. I loved that phrase that he put before me. He said, learn to be obedient in your disobedience. Meaning, when you mess up, you know you can actually make the problem a lot worse by spiraling down this cycle of shame. You actually just dig a deeper and deeper hole for yourself rather than turning from the sin and saying, no, I'm not going to be ashamed of that. So examples of this, right? I feel like a lot of us, if we're not careful, we start to project our own experiences with discipline and punishment onto God, and we think that that's how he operates. So for me, growing up, it was, man, I messed up. You need to give dad some space for a little bit. You don't go poke the bear right now. You go take some time away for a little bit. Go think about what you did. Give it a couple hours. Let him calm down and simmer down, right? A lot of us probably had this experience. You don't go right away because that's probably not going to end well. They're heated. Things are going to get hot. That was for me. And if I'm not careful, I do that to God sometimes. Where when I make a mistake, I go, man, God needs some space for me. I'm gonna go feel bad about myself for a couple hours. That's going to help. That's going to fix it. The solution, the response and solution to sin is not to feel worse about yourself. That's just making the problem so much worse for you. God doesn't need time and space for you to calm down. He's a perfect and loving, holy God. He doesn't need to simmer down. He doesn't want you to go hide for 2 hours to go feel bad about what you've done. No, the response in our sin should be that we run back to him over and over and over and over again and say, God, thank you that you love me enough. Thank you for your grace. Thank you for your forgiveness. But again, we have to change the way that we think about this, church. Are you projecting your experiences onto God? Are you believing something that's not true about him? Because what is true about him is that Romans 8 says, there's nothing that can separate you from his love. Nothing. He loves you. He doesn't want you to sit in shame. So we turn from sin, and shame. And then the last point I have for you guys is this, is that we need to be intentional about obedience. In order to change the way that we think about sin and to change the way that we think about obedience, we have to be intentional about it. Be intentional about obedience. Loved a conversation that we had this week with our friend Chris that came to our brainstorming. This is all his credit. It's not mine, man. It was so good. So I'm going to tell you what he said. He goes, you know, the times when before Christ, you used to like plan and prepare to go out and sin. You used to plan to go out to the bar. You used to have a whole game plan for what you were going to do that night. He goes, I feel like the same thing has to happen when we consider obedience. We have to plan and prepare to be obedient to God. It's not just going to come naturally. You're not just going to wake up one day and all of a sudden want to follow God. That's actually quite the opposite. You have this inclination to want to sin and not choose God's ways. So you have to be intentional about it. You have to wake up and plan and prepare. God, how am I going to follow you today? How am I going to trust you today? Having a game plan for obedience is going to be so helpful. Paul writes in 1 Timothy, he says, physical training is good, but training for godliness is much better, promising benefits in this life and the life to come. You have to train for it, meaning you have to practice it. And practicing means that you have to start somewhere. It's not just going to happen. You have to create better habits. You have to have a better game plan when you wake up at the beginning of the day before you get to the end of the day and go, what the heck happened today? It's being intentional about obedience. And this is not just being intentional about listening to God's commands. I think it's so much more than that that we don't recognize. We shared with our students this last week. It was a great conversation. We talked about the idea that we're so highly influenced by the people around us. We're so highly influenced by what we spend time doing, by what we spend time thinking about, by what we spend time listening to. We're so influenced by a variety of factors, and we start to become more like the people that we spend time around. Would you guys agree? You start to become more like those people. So you know a really wonderful way that you can be intentional about obedience? Start spending more time with Jesus and watch what happens. You start spending more time with him this week, watch what happens. Just watch. I challenge you to do that. Spend more time with him than you normally would. Spend more time reading his word than you normally would and just watch what happens. And so as we get ready to sing some songs here, some more songs to Jesus and about Jesus for who he is and what he's done, this is one of the ways that here on a weekend service, we want to help do that with you, to be intentional about him by taking time to sing these songs and reflect. Reflect and be thankful for who he is and what he's done as we sing those words. There would be a moment for you at your seats as you stand, as you sit, whatever. To say, God, I'm going to be intentional in this moment with you. I'm going to get rid of the distractions, and I'm going to remember who you are and what you've done. Another way that we want to do that with you guys as well is that we have four tables of communion here around the room. You guys can take that piece of bread and that juice that's a reminder of who Jesus is and what he's done. It's all about reminding yourself. God, remind me when I get distracted. Remind me when I get lost. Remind me of who you are and what you've done. And so those are two ways that we're going to do that with you guys this morning. Encourage you to take full advantage of that about being intentional. But it's not just being here on a Sunday and singing songs about God that's going to do it for you, church. I just got to be real with you. That's not going to be enough for you. What's going to be so invaluable for you is what you take outside of these four walls and what you do out there. What you do at home, what you do at work, what you do when life gets stressful, what you do when you're anxious. This intentionality about obedience is so much going to stem from those things. What are you going to do this week? Reading his word more, learning more about him, spending more time with him, thinking about him more, praying more. You become so much like the people that you spend time with. So spend more time with Jesus this week. And just watch what happens. Be intentional about that. I encourage you to try that this week. So we're going to pray as we get ready to sing some more songs to Jesus for who he is and what he's done. Lord, we come before you this morning just thankful. Thankful for your word, which is good and is true. My prayer for myself and everybody in these seats this morning, would you remind us that your way is so much better? Lord, that we would choose to be, that we would choose you as a good master over sin, which is a terrible master for us. Lord, that we would recognize that you have the best life in store for us. We would be able to trust that and follow you.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this podcast. For more resources, check out gotocrosspoint.com.